it's time for a bonus. A bonus episode. I love episodes of theater. We're going off the beaten path. We're off.
Oh, hey.
Hey.
Oh, hello.
What's up? Hey. Funny seeing you here.
Hi. Funny seeing you here.
What are you trying to say?
Nothing. I think you know.
Wow. Wow.
And this is our shortest episode.
Oh, are we?
Everybody. Bye, everybody.
We're recording? Okay, yeah, bye. We'll see you later. No,
I
hey,
said
friends.
Good day. Hello,
it's good
friends.
To see you.
Good to see you.
I'm excited. This is a big little, big little mini-series we're doing here.
It really is.
Big
it's
little.
Quite a mixture of movies.
It is. We're
it
doing
really
some fun
is.
Stuff. Is there anything we wanted to start off with? Do we want to banter? Are we in the banter mood?
I just want to give a shout out to Paul Sorvino and David Warner, who passed this week.
Sure.
Legends, both legends. I have to shout out Time After Time. Was the first time I remember David Warner. If you've never seen Time After Time, it is... it is a groovy sci-fi action thriller about H.G. Wells tracking down Jack the Ripper using his time machine in modern day America, and it's pretty great. And it's pretty great.
It's kind of fun.
And David Warner plays Jack the Ripper. And
Tony Dow passed away on the day that we're recording this as well. He was Wally in Leave It to Beaver. Another great actor and producer and writer. Yeah, you know, he was doing a lot of stuff.
I actually I actually got to shake his hand. When I was a youngster living in Okinawa, the Happy Days gang. This is a true story.
Sunday, Monday,
the Happy Days gang, which included cast members. Henry Winkler was there and production members and stuff would travel military bases around the world and play softball against, like, local, you know, like, softball teams.
Wow.
And so they all came there, and they did this huge thing for the schools. And then they, like, kind of did a meet and greet. And I got to shake
Tony Dow's hand. Yeah, that's pretty cool.
Yeah,
that's
right? Fine. Yeah.
My dad was a huge Tony Dow fan. I don't know why. I don't know if he was just, like, a big Leave It to Beaver fan, but he would bring him up often. That's all I remember. It was kind of weird. No, but that's all sad and terrible, but, like, they left marks, right? They undeniable marks. Let's get into it. I am so excited to talk about these four movies. We have two that were prepped to record today, and we'll see how we feel at the end of this episode. We might break them up into multiple parts so you can choose what you want to listen to.
Yeah.
Normally we do two of these at a time, but no, this is a podcast. So I'm gonna should I introduce it?
What?
Yeah, let's do it.
Is that what we're calling it now?
Yeah. Oh yes. The official term now that we've hit over 100 episodes is podcast. Welcome to Theater, the theater podcast for theater nerds, made by three theater makers from the LA theater scene. I'm J. Bailey Bertram.
I'm C.J. Merriman.
And I'm Scott Leggett.
And as always, to cleanse our palate between every fifth playwright. Well, I'm not going to do the cleanse the palate thing. That's what I say for the end stuffs. That's not real. We're back with another bonus miniseries. It's a bonus miniseries. Every five playwrights, we take a break and we watch some movies.
Yes.
Usually theater related. Actually, they have been pretty much every time.
Yeah.
And this is part one of movie musicals, right?
Musicals that are movies.
Musicals that are movies. So
yes.
No, you're wrong.
That's incorrect.
This is
movies
musicals.
That were musicals.
Correct. This is movies that were musicals. I'll get it
right on the cover art.
Because what you're saying, CJ, would be movies that were just movies. Musicals that were only ever movies.
What I was trying to say and didn't say it well was musicals turned into movies.
Mm. Yeah.
So my bad. Well,
right. No, but that's correct. because normally we do turning plays into movies. We could do turning musicals into movies. We'll call this one that. Production meeting. Done.
Done.
Noted in the log.
Noting in the log right now. Okay. There we
go. And normally for these, we would be joined by our dear friend, Pam Quinn. She writes all of our songs for all of our episodes. You just heard a song by her at the top of this episode. It's the bonus episode song. It's time for a bonus. And she's fantastic. She could not make it for this recording session this week. I think she just hates us. But that's a different conversation.
We've had some talks lately.
We've had some talks. Yeah. No, not for real. But she's excited to get into it next week because she chose her choices next time.
Next week.
So, this time, however, over the course of this miniseries, we're going to be covering four movie musicals. This time, we're going to be covering Fiddler on the Roof.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And Little Shop of Horrors.
Mm-hmm.
And then next week, with Pam, we're going to be covering Into the Woods, Disney's Into the Woods. Yes, Disney's Into the Woods.
Uh-huh.
And also the new Steven Spielberg West Side Story. So that's going to be an absolute blast. We might break these up into four episodes, but for now, this is part one of turning musicals into plays. Welcome. No, fuck. Turning musicals into movies.
Your face, your anger at yourself.
We can't even edit it because we laugh so hard. Turning musicals into movies.
Yes.
We did
it. You did it.
And this is Fiddler on the Roof. So yeah, very excited. Any initial thoughts before CJ breaks it down?
What a fucking, whether this is just episode one and two or just episode one, what a mix of movie, of musicals turned into movies to cover. They were fun to watch back to back.
It is
agreed. Just so different, each one of them. And Nostalgia Ultra.
Oh, my God. Yes.
Nostalgia Ultra. Like, all four of them, even because I know West Side Story only came out this year, right?
Mm-hmm.
But it brings me back to the multiple times I've been in West Side Story, the multiple times I've seen West Side Story, the billion times I watched the original movie as a child.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And there's a nostalgia there, too. And then Into the Woods just as a musical. We'll get to my opinions on that film later.
Yes.
Which I'm sure we all have. But Fiddler specific, I kind of want to know your context with it. I kind of skipped that. I want to know how you grew up knowing Fiddler, or did you? How were you introduced to it? Scott, start us off.
Oh, man. I remember seeing a lovely production. It stuck in my head for a long time when I was like young, like 7 or 8. I don't know if it was a college or a touring company. I don't remember. I just remember kind of being a kid, and I think I was with my folks and just going, this is great. It was long. I remember it being long and feeling that, but that I was just so mesmerized by it. I've never done it. I've seen like 2 or 3 productions of it. And then I remember, this is dating myself real bad, but I remember when it came out on home video for the first time.
Yeah.
And that was kind of a big deal, and they had like remastered it and cleaned it up, and it was sort of the beginning of that phase of home video where it's like, we've remastered it. We went back and cleaned it up. And
was it like mid-80s?
Yeah, right around there, mid to late 80s. But I remember just watching the film, and we'll talk more about the director, Norman Jewison, and what a fucking eclectic, weird career he had, and just how meticulous it was. I really just, and I loved doing the rewatch of it. It's just cool.
Agreed. Siege, what is your relationship with Fiddler?
Well, the first thing I wanted to say was that this was my pick, and I did not realize until I rewatched it yesterday that Norman Jewison also directed my first musical turned into movie pick, Jesus Christ Superstar.
That's correct. That is correct.
I did not do that on purpose.
Outing here, if we're all being honest with ourselves,
Sure. But Fiddler on the Roof, I had the double cassette tape box of this. And I actually, like, my I remember my dad always talked about it, and we either had a record, it was a record cover from like the Broadway cast with that old painting on the front of it.
Yeah.
And so I remember always seeing that image at home, and my dad talked about it all the time. Dad always famously says he loves Fiddler on the Roof, but it gets so sad after the wedding.
Well, yeah, Act Two is heavy. Yeah, the pogrom and such. Yes, it's
Act
hard.
One. Well, and we'll get
the end
it.
Of Act One. Yeah, sure.
Yes, and I both of these I came to as a kid, and then I did Fiddler on the Roof in between my sophomore and junior year in high school at our like summer theater guild thing, and I it was a tough production because I really wanted to be Hoddle, and I got put in like the ensemble, and the gal that played Hoddle couldn't sing as well as me, but I was mad about it the whole time. But I do love this musical, and then didn't even get to the movie until I started doing the play that summer, and then I watched the movie all the time, and it's one of those movies like Jesus Christ Superstar that as soon as the opening credits start, or as soon as the opening tune starts, I'm crying. Like, there's so many banger songs in this musical, and I love
so
it
many.
So much. Okay. Yeah.
I grew up watching the film. Topol film. Obviously, it was one of those that was in our house. I think we had a VHS, and we would just put it on sometimes, right? Yep. Same with Oliver! Exclamation point. Same cinematographer. We'll get to that later.
Yeah.
And just one of those movies that I knew forwards and backwards as like a 7-year-old. Little Shop actually was the same way. So those were two musicals I was introduced to really early in life. I played Tevye my junior year of high school. And I got the part over a senior, and it was drama.
It
was
drama. Shit.
Oh, I love it.
And even more drama, which I will never do this because this created so much shit. But they double cast all of the female leads.
Oh.
So the three daughters and Golda were all double cast, and it was cast with one cast upperclassmen, one cast underclassmen, and they both got the same amount of performances.
Oh.
So it wasn't like a special, it was like they could have cast it out of the underclassmen, but they felt like they couldn't do that.
Yeah.
So they, but however, I will say both casts were actually phenomenal. I went to a arts high school from preschool through high school, and they had a lot of money in the theater department, and so we did pretty massive productions. The sets were all built by Michael Downs, who does things for the Olympics and MTV and all over New York and LA, and it was a fully produced Fiddler. Like, it felt really real. Now, I am not Jewish.
Yeah,
I probably won't ever be able to play this role ever again, but it was so fun. And it was years later, I got asked to come back for a huge benefit at the school, and they just asked me to do Rich Man. And I was like, sure. And, you know, like that kind of like it's my one little legacy at the school, it feels like, where people remember me for that in some ways.
If you don't mind me asking, where was your voice vocally? Like, were you a solid baritone by the age?
Yeah, now, okay, that's an interesting question, Scott, because I grew up in a traveling boy choir my whole life, with the same voice teacher my whole life, who I was a high soprano when I started in boy choir, right?
Mm-hmm.
Ended up in alto by like 7th or 8th grade, but I was singing tenor one my first 2 years of high school.
Ah.
I found weed my sophomore year of high school.
By
the time I was a junior and senior, I was hitting the lowest bass notes in choir, but I could still sing tenor two. Like, I couldn't hit my really upper register anymore.
Yeah, smoking will kill that tenor one.
It really
sure.
killed it. It really, really did. Like, I actually, I'm going to my kids and beyond, I'm going to make sure people know that, because it did. It just killed like some of those upper register notes that I had been training for years, and just couldn't do them anymore. And I, if someone had asked me at the time, I would have said baritone because I could do the range, right?
Okay, gotcha.
course, I, you know, that same year, I think I went in and sang Maria from West Side Story at an audition for Grease, the musical. And I optioned up to the higher note in it, and I hit it. And I, like, hadn't ever hit it in a rehearsal, and I did it. And I was like, oh, I still have it. And then I got cast in a role that has to hit that note, and I, like, never could do it again.
Oh, no.
But it was fine. All that to say, yeah, I had a pretty great range. I was a singer. I was singer more than actor as a kid. That was more my thing. I was a choir kid. I was also a band kid, so I saw myself as a musician. Mm. I really fell deeply in love with musicals starting with when I was in Fiddler. Mm. It was Aww. The moment where I was like, "Oh, I could do this." Right? Like I could go to school for this and I could really like maybe fall in love with this. And Fiddler as a show, I love from top to bottom. I often put it in my top five musicals. Sometimes it gets bumped by something just in the moment, but it's just something that has to be in my top 10. And I love the movie and I have a lot to say about it, so I want to get into it. But first, I think we need to tell people what this thing's about. So, CJ,
Yeah.
I love when you do this, by the way. It's one of my favorite things on the podcast. I love that we added this season, and I want you to keep doing it forever. So, break it the fuck down.
Break it down.
CJ's Breakdown.
In 1905, Tevye, a poor milkman in the village of Anatevka, attempts to maintain his Jewish religious and cultural traditions as outside influences encroach upon his family's lives.
Yeah, like a motherfucker they do.
It's a very basic telling of it, but I didn't want to divulge too much.
Well, and that's great because it sets up everything that I was thinking about this time through. And watching it, where I was really kind of like, I really want to identify these themes and where it goes. And I think it's a juxtaposition of the existential outside forces and then the very human internal forces that create the change that happens and the power of tradition that we're going to set up tradition so that we can crack it apart, and, you know, in a beautiful but sad way.
Something I'm finding rereading all of these plays that we've been doing and rewatching all of this stuff, especially these movie musicals that like I've grew up with, that I loved as a kid, that I loved them because I liked the characters and I liked the songs.
Yeah.
To be this age now and have a greater understanding of it's like, you know, when I was a kid, it was just about World War II and the Holocaust. But now to have a greater understanding of what historically was going on at the time and just a greater understanding of, like, I don't know, human emotion and struggle and everything, watching it this time felt so much different than it did when I watched it when I was 16.
Absolutely. Sure. Absolutely. There'd be something wrong with you if that wasn't the case, you know?
Right.
Right. Right.
There might be something wrong with you, CJ.
There is, absolutely. I can tell
there's a lot.
Blood coming out of your ears right now. Yeah. So I think it's important to point out, you know, we're here to talk about the movie mostly and like how it did and like in our take on the movie as a form of movie musical. But I want to shout out the original musical came out in 1964. Mm-hmm. And it's a Bach and Harnack, or Harnack and Bach, or however you want to say it. It's Jerry Bach and Sheldon Harnack. I think the book is by Joseph Stein.
Yeah.
Double checking that. Yes, mm-hmm. Joseph Stein. And it is based on the Sholem Aleichem book, Tevye and His Daughters, also known as Tevye the Dairyman, which is like it's just a collection of Jewish stories, right? Cultural Jewish stories set around that time. And it's the first musical to surpass 3,000 performances on Broadway. So we should note that right away. It's the first one that it held blows the record, things up.
It held the record until Grease
Until 10 years. Yeah. For almost 10 years, it held the record. And then, Grease comes out, blows it out of the water with its run. And then since then, 10 things have beaten it. And now it's, I think, still... Is it still it's Phantom?
No, it was I think Cats, for that wasn't
Andrew
it?
Lloyd Webber
is it
Cats?
It's either Cats or Phantom. One is as the longest running. No, but Cats, I think, has been... Oh, I don't know.
Is that Les Mis?
We have Google.
No.
No, it's not Les Mis. They don't have a consistently running Les Mis on Broadway. They have a consistently running Phantom on Broadway for 30 years now.
Wow.
Yeah.
All right.
Look it up, Scott.
I'm looking it up.
Anyway, so I wanted to shout that out because then about, you know, 7 years later, they make the film. And I want to talk about Norman Jewison, the director of this. So this is his, I mean, he's done a couple of major things before this. Specifically, he's done some cool TV. He did the Judy Garland hour or whatever it was called. I'm trying to find it. He did like an hour with Danny Kaye, the Broadway of Lerner and Lowe and the Judy Garland show. He would direct a lot of these things for TV. His first really massive hit is In the Heat of the Night, which is a phenomenal film. Scott, I feel like you like In the Heat of the Night.
Oh my God. It's,
yeah.
Well, and you have, and it's a movie that you have to put in context. And I remember just as a kid seeing it, and it kind of shook you a little bit.
Yeah.
But yeah, Sidney Poitier.
Phenomenal film.
You know.
Poitier is maybe one of his best, like truly phenomenal film. And what it was doing racially, racial politics in America and film right then, it was
And Steiger is the sheriff. And
he slaps him at one point. Sidney slaps him, and it was this huge deal.
That's all I remember.
After that, he does Thomas Crown Affair and Gaily Gaily, but then he does Fiddler on the Roof and sort of falls in love with musicals. The next year, he had done musical things before, but he does Fiddler on the Roof. Then he does Jesus Christ Superstar 2 years later.
Mm-hmm.
And then he does one of my favorite movies, Rollerball.
Rollerball.
Starring James Caan.
Is the shit.
I love that movie.
I love Rollerball.
Yeah. I love Rollerball.
Such a weird fucking flick, too.
Yeah,
man.
No, it's so incredible. Weird. And they remade it in the 2000s, and I don't remember that one, but the original's rad.
Yeah, watch the original.
It's like if Logan's Run met Solar Babies or something, and had like I don't know. It's just it's
and
so
then they
good.
Played hockey. It was
yeah. So then, besides that, he did the Agnes of God movie. He did a Soldier's Story. He also directed the Shanley written film starring Cher, Moonstruck.
Yeah,
another phenomenal film. He did the Hurricane with
Denzel
and these kind
Denzel
of things, right?
Credits him a lot. He did an interview when he directed what's the film he directed that Denzel did?
John Q. I don't know. What did he do?
Anyway, but he talks about Norman Jewison, that's who he stole from as a director, and he's like he always starts off with starts with a static shot.
Didn't he direct Fences? Is that what you're talking
he did,
about?
No.
Antoine Fisher?
Antoine Fisher.
Fisher rocks.
It does. And he directed it. But he steals straight from Norman Jewison.
Underrated
film. Every shot starts with a static object and then backs up into the action of the moment. And
interesting.
It's really cool. Like, and listening to Denzel talk about him. But yeah, just an amazingly eclectic career. And like pretty consistently great quality. Agnes of God is really like, ooh, that.
Yeah,
like,
I've never seen that one.
Yeah, it's good. The play is good too, but the movies in particular. Anne Bancroft's in it. Jane Fonda.
That's a good one. So she's a good one. I want to kiss her. real quick, just because you know I like this stuff, the awards, it gets some Oscars. Okay. Yeah. Now, this is the same year, 1971, this is the same year as French Connection. So French Connection sweeps everything this year.
Yeah, I mean,
it's like you can't ignore
French Connection.
However, we get some great noms and some wins. We were nominated. Topol gets nominated for Best Actor. Leonard Frey gets nominated for Model, which is kind of a great nomination.
Were those the two? No, because Topol hadn't been doing it on Broadway. It was Zero Mostel, right?
Yes. So we'll get to that in a sec, because I actually have a lot to say about that. It's really interesting.
Another JC superstar.
That's right.
Yeah.
So then picture, it gets a Best Picture nom and a Best Director nom. It doesn't win any of those, but it does win Best Sound Mixing, Best Original Music Score, which was done by who? Major composer of right now. Who is
Lin-Manuel Miranda?
No. That would be awesome. No. John Williams. John Williams did the score to this
shit.
Film. Can you believe that?
No shit.
So all the extra music that surrounds when they're not singing and stuff. He uses themes from the songs, but he does all of the extra music. Incredible. John Williams.
Yeah.
We love John Williams.
Here.
So it gets music score, sound mixing, and it also wins best cinematography. Now, I just want to take one digression.
I think you're going to do the same digression I wanted to.
That's legit, because this cinematographer, it's a beautiful, beautiful film, right? From top to bottom. I think it looks better than maybe any other movie musical of the time. I think it's like, we'll get to that too. But his name's Oswald Morris. He also did Oliver! ! The movie. He also did a couple of Bond movies, specifically some Roger Moore Bond movies.
Yeah.
He did The Wiz.
Which is a good-looking film.
Which is a good-looking film, weird one that we'll definitely
weird
talk about soon because
design.
We're covering the... Right, but we're covering the live NBC of it, so we'll definitely have to talk about that movie. He did The Great Muppet Caper.
Here.
One of my favorite films of all time. And Dark Crystal. Jim Henson's Dark Crystal, and we'll get to Jim Henson later in this episode talking a little bit about Little Shop. So
more crossovers.
Cool. Now, one of the number one films that he did, though, what he made most of his money on was a film that I think he was also nominated for this film that we have talked about on this podcast a few times, but we've never actually covered it. This is Lolita.
Mm-hmm.
He is the cinematographer for the Kubrick Lolita. Yes.
I see.
Yeah. So, but I love this guy.
Okay. I have one. Oswald Morris digression.
Okay.
I don't want to step on your toes though.
I don't have it.
Okay. I'm going to read. He was famous for shooting color films in unusual styles to shoot the film in an earthy tone. Morris saw a woman wearing brown nylon hosiery and thought, that's the tone we want. Asked the woman for the stockings on the spot and shot the entire film with the stocking over the lens.
In
some of the shots, particularly they pointed one out in Matchmaker, you can see the weave of the stocking.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's kind of cool.
Create filter, And then in terms of the original design, it was Marc Chagall?
It also got a production design Oscar nomination, by the way. I forgot about that. Sorry.
But that's, you can see him pulling on that. And he does just some amazing compositions of shots. Like, if you notice that if there was a group of people talking and they would do the cut, whoever they were cutting to, whoever the center of that moment was, would be then framed by the people around them in a really interesting way. Like, the men are all... like gathered around the milk cart, and the first time the guy shows up with the newspaper with the bad news, and then as they cut and you have like three or four characters talking to one another, every time they cut, the composition of them is that they're surrounded by the other ones on levels, and it's just really cool. Like, I was really knocked out by not just the look of it, and we'll also have to talk about the acid nightmare freakout scene that Tevye has.
I love
Sarah.
Sarah's one of my favorite scenes ever.
Yes.
I love it.
And it's so gorgeous in its design and photography. But yeah, I was really knocked out by how good it still looks with all the technology. I mean,
for sure.
He's shooting all that with, a 500-pound camera. Yeah.
Something that definitely hit me differently this time around is, again, growing up in the all-white, all-Christian Midwest, the thing that people always talked about, especially my mom, was the Russian tenor solo in L'Chaim. Mm. And how beautiful that is and how it just stops the show.
Yeah, so
good. Then watching it this time, I was like, instead of sitting there in the audience and marveling at how amazing this Russian tenor is, it's like, this is a threat. This scene should be tense.
And
this is foreshadowing to the wedding. Yeah,
it's
but
that way, right?
I've never noticed it before.
Oh, wow. Okay. Wow. Yeah, I mean, I think it has to have that tension of, are they about to beat us up and knock us out of here?
Right.
And then he ends up being like, no, we're... Because that's actually the tension of the first note. He holds that, or whatever it is, and they all just stop and they're like, what do we do? And then he starts singing... slowly this thing, and they're kind of like, okay.
Right.
And then they slowly encroach upon each other until by the end they're dancing in a whole heap. By the way, the senior who I beat for Tevye played that role. So
when we did it at our community theater, it's like if they did Carousel there, like, oh, I love this musical, as opposed to like actually realizing what's going on. The person that played the Russian tenor was this kid that was known in our area for having this big, beautiful tenor voice. And it was just a moment for him to take center stage and everyone be like, oh, he got that part. You know what I mean?
Right, yeah. Right.
And sometimes you have to do that, and you can, layer it in. I guess one of the criticisms of the original musical, as well as the film, was that role, that the all of the Russians, specifically the one, the main Russian guy, many felt that it was watered down. In the original stories, it is not a friendly relationship. It is almost like a prison guard, and it's a brutal thing. And Tevye is very much afraid of him. And in the movie, he plays it. I think Topol plays it so well. He's being very respectful. He's nodding, but he knows that this dude could take him out like that.
Yeah, well, and I read too that, I guess, and it's been a while since I've experienced the live musical, but like Norman Jewison was specifically going to make the movie a little bit even more serious than the live musical is.
Mm.
Well, that's, I don't know. I read it on IMDb. Well, I don't know if I think that's true or not, but
well, that is the tome of all truth. So
yeah. And I think that, you know, this is a long musical, and as we talked about earlier, that second act is dark, and you don't have the big showstoppers that you have in the first act. You don't have If I Were a Rich Man. You don't have Tradition. You don't have Matchmaker in the second act. Everything's more somber and dark.
Still slaps, though.
Still slaps. Oh, I'm not. That's not a criticism.
There's some great numbers in the second act. Yeah, yeah.
For sure. But all I'm saying is that on stage, I think you would need to turn up. You know, find a little bit more release valve humor, kind of wackier stuff. Like, B. Arthur was the original Matchmaker on Broadway.
Is that right?
Yeah,
she was crazy.
The original Yenta. Yeah, isn't that crazy?
Star Wars holiday specials, B. Arthur?
Yes, correct. Yes. Exactly. And you know, we should also say real quick, because I want to talk Topol, and I want to start kind of going through the cast a little bit. Norman Jewison was not Jewish.
Right.
No.
In fact, he was hired when the producers thought he was.
Yeah.
Right.
I think because of his last name, maybe. But they fucked that up. It's pretty hilarious. Okay, Topol. Chaim Topol is his real name. But he goes by Topol. And here's some interesting things about Topol, okay? He was playing Tevye in the Tel Aviv Fiddler when they were searching for their Tevye, okay? He had done a couple of films. He had actually even done one English-speaking film where he had to, like, learn English through those lines. He did not know English through the making of this film.
Wow.
So he was being directed a bit by a interpreter, but he was also learning English through this script.
That's amazing.
So he had already been sort of learning it, but he couldn't fully, he wasn't fluent.
Lugosi. Bela Lugosi learned English by learning Dracula phonetically.
Dracula.
That's 100%. Why he sounds like this.
Yeah.
It's because he was he was memorizing syllables and sounds, not words.
And now that's how we play him every time.
That's
whole way. Yeah. I want to suck your blood. And so Topol is kind of the same situation. He gets plucked out of the Tel Aviv production because some producer had just seen him in it and was just like, oh, he could do it. And so they plucked him out. He gets the role and he goes on to be a huge American star. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean,
he was just at the Pantages like 5 or 6 years ago playing.
Was
Tevye.
He?
Yes.
Yeah. Right.
That's amazing.
Passed, yeah.
And he's only
he's still alive.
Oh,
he's
is
only
he?
Like, he's alive.
Oh, my bad.
He's like 35.
He's in 35
this film? 35
in this
film?
Yeah.
He's like 32 playing Tevye in Tel Aviv.
Right.
And so he plays it for like a few years, and then And then they cast him. And so two movies I really loved him in as a kid, because I would search, I would fall in love with actors and then I would search out all of their filmography, mm-hmm. right? So I really love For Your Eyes Only, which is a Roger
Moore.
I was
just about to bring it up.
Okay, phenomenal film. And then the other one I would argue, I maybe think of this before I think of Fiddler when I think of Topol sometimes, is Hans Zarkov in Flash Gordon.
Yes.
Which is one of my favorite films of all time. One of the best sci-fi films maybe ever. Which also has Brian Blessed and Timothy Dalton.
Dalton is in it.
Very interesting. So real quick, because I want to hear your thoughts on Topol, I want to tell you two other people that they considered for this role. Okay. The first one, they originally asked Danny Kaye.
Yeah, I get it. I get why. Because this is we should also say this is an MGM United Artists co-production. These are two huge studios.
Yeah. They're wanting huge stars. But Danny Kaye at the time, like, had he made his... I mean, he's definitely a massive star. But, like, where is he in terms of musicals right now? I don't even know.
Like, well, he'd
White Christmas.
At that point, he had done White Christmas. He'd
but,
done
like, what's surrounding this? Like, yeah.
I'm looking.
Yeah.
Because White Christmas is so long before this.
I think by that point, I think by this point, so we're talking late 60s, early 70s.
He's on the Danny Kaye show? Is that still going on?
Yeah, he had his show, which was
okay?
A variety.
Are you okay? Are you
going to
die?
No, I'm fine.
Is it COVID?
No. I've got it. Here comes Peter Cottontail.
Yeah, he's doing TV movies. He's on Rowan and Martin's Laughing in the 70s.
He's doing a lot of review kind of stuff.
Yeah, he's kind of fallen off. He, you know, he ends up doing Captain Hook and Mr. Darling in a Peter Pan TV movie in 76. He's all over the place, but he's you know, I mean, it's interesting. So I was thinking maybe The Court Jester was around this time. Court Jester came out in 1955, right after White Christmas.
Yeah, it was long before.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So his career has sort of waned by this time. He's about a decade out. His show has been canceled by this point, mm-hmm. Danny Kaye show. So anyway, they asked him first. The other person who begged for this role. By the way, Danny Kaye turned it down because his wife told him he was too young. She was looking out for his image. Now, he would have been like 45, 50. But she was like, no, you can't start taking old roles yet. And he was like, okay. So he didn't take it. The person who really wanted this role and begged and begged and begged for it was Frank Sinatra.
I read that too. And I was like,
what the hell? Wouldn't have made sense. And besides Guys and Dolls, I know he was always looking for those roles. He always wanted to be in movie musicals. That was like a big thing for him. But he never really gets any of them besides this one.
No,
right? Is he in Pal Joey? I don't know. He's in something
else. You know, he did a lot of movies, but he didn't do a lot of musicals.
Not stage shows that became movies, though, right?
No, not at all.
And
what a weird
IMDb
choice. Like, you know.
Also, Frank Sinatra's a fucking motherfucker.
Well, you're probably
he's not a motherfucker. He's a child fucker.
Yeah, he ended up being a real right winger weirdo, especially towards the end of his life. So.
And a pedophile and a terrible person. Yeah, a lot of terrible, terrible things.
I'm glad it wasn't him.
He and Dean Martin can go ahead and
fuck off and die.
Home. Wow, they did that already. But yeah. cut all of that, Scott. Jeez,
I'm not cutting any of it.
The ghosts of Martin and Sinatra.
Okay. Let them come.
They'll be fine. We'll be all right.
Let them come.
I guess he did do On the Town. Is that was that a musical first or a movie first? I don't even know.
I think it was a movie first.
I think
you're
right.
It was a movie musical.
I think you're right. It was a movie musical. So it wasn't a musical that was turned into a movie, which is what we're covering here. So we're not going to fucking talk about it anymore.
We should do a shout out to Zero.
Well, okay, so the original obviously was Zero Mostel, who they didn't even really approach.
He was playing it on Broadway, right?
Yeah, Norman
Jewison
felt
at the time playing it on Broadway.
He
had finished by that point.
Oh, got it.
But Norman Jewison just felt that he was Zero Mostel.
Yeah.
And that you would never get past that it was Zero Mostel, and then he needed somebody who would, you know, come to define that role, and he picked it like a motherfucker. He nailed it.
Other people that have played Tevye that I think are important, Alfred Molina played Tevye in the revival, which I used to listen to that one a good amount, actually. I listened to that over the Zero Mostel. And then also Danny Burstein did it, what, 3 years ago now? 4 years ago now? They did sort of a modern twist on the beginning and end, as if they were like coming together to tell this story to you, and sounds interesting. I don't think he won the Tony. I think he was nominated. It was like his sixth Tony nomination, and he still didn't win. Completely insane. I'm a huge Danny Burstein fan. He did Luther Billis in the South Pacific at Lincoln Center in 2006 or whenever that was. I'm a big fan. Big fan. He was in Moulin Rouge most recently. He was the dude, the Ziegler.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's fun.
And on Broadway. Okay. Well, good times, y'all. Yeah. What are your Topol takes? Give me your Topol takes.
Oh my God.
Man, I think he just nails it. Like he's just, like I said, that scene where he's talking to the guard for the first time. Yes, Your Honor. No, Your Honor.
Yeah.
He's great. And I love how they stage the monologues and the asides. They, all of a sudden there's this great distance between whomever he's talking about. And,
oh yeah.
Those little things. And then, you know, you just love him. You just love that he has a joie de vivre, and that he loves his family so much. It's just so obvious. So
I do wonder if you love him so much that Golda becomes just a nagging wife, though. That's something to consider.
Oh, I don't feel that way.
Okay, good. Because I know that some people have looked at it, especially in the Jewish community, and been like, feels like a stereotype. I think, especially with the way Norma Crane plays it, I don't feel that. I think she is actually more than anything sort of just like so aware of who her husband is that she's just like, okay, well, go do this thing anyway.
You can die from such a man. Well, and you know, you read too, she found out when they were filming this that she had breast cancer, and she only died two years later.
Aww.
So only Topol and Norman knew.
Yeah.
That she was suffering and during filming.
She is phenomenal. She's not, and CJ, I want to hear your Topol take. But I don't, we'll get to her. We'll get to her, because I think she's next. We'll talk about her next. Go ahead, Siege.
Something I think that Topol does really, I mean, he's just amazing from top to bottom. Like, I don't know, he is Tevye to me. I've never seen it any other way. I've only done the play myself. So
you didn't see me in 2007?
I didn't, I'm
it's
sorry.
It's fine. Sold out houses, but it's fine.
The other thing that I connected with so much with this, and he is so lovable, and you immediately connect with him, is you're not only dealing with like historically what's going on at this time, but then also just the other parent stuff of your daughters leaving and getting married and moving away and trying new things. And maybe they're not going to stay home, and maybe they won't be safe. And like
the train station scene.
Yeah, you connect to the family dynamic too. And because, like, I remember again back in all white, all Christian Midwest, my friends talking about their parents always cry whenever they hear the song Sunrise, Sunset, because that's something any parent can connect to.
Sure.
Yeah. Agreed. And that's the way that's filmed is so beautiful. And they don't use any electric lighting. It's all candlelight.
Yeah.
And it's like thousands of candles. I'm sure a fire broke out at some point. Like, it's just like just supposedly absolutely breathtaking even to just be on set that day. I love that song so much. And I think you're right. I think he specifically, Topol, brings that to this so well.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And even just
you
that first Sabbath prayer. Like, yeah. That first Sabbath prayer, I used to ask my parents if we could do something like that, because I was just like, this feels like they're so in sync with each other. We never are like that. Let's do that, right? I want to talk about Golda.
The traditions are really beautiful. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely beautiful. I want to talk about Golda, Norma Crane. She's absolutely incredible. She's, I don't think, the strongest singer in this film.
I think she's more of a character actress.
100%.
Yeah.
But she's doing some interesting stuff. Can I tell you real quick some other people that were considered for this role?
Yeah.
Colleen Dewhurst, Zoe Caldwell, Dorothy Loudon, Lee Grant, and the one that actually Norma Crane kind of looks like, Anne Bancroft.
Yeah.
Oh, that, yeah, I read that.
Which would have been great. Yeah. Anne Bancroft would have been great. And she's also a singer, and she's, you know, well, I don't know how how much singing she really did, but she sings in that one Mel Brooks movie, the Chairs or whatever. What is that called? What is it? Not the Chairs.
I don't know.
You know what I'm talking about?
Well, they were married.
Or is it To Be or Not to Be? She's in
To Be or Not to Be. Yeah, they were.
Yeah,
they were
one of those.
Married. It was one of the great romances in Hollywood.
So beautiful. Anyway, I'm mixing up all my pop culture today, y'all. I apologize. but I think she's fantastic in this. And yeah, I think it can be seen as that to some people, but you also, it's in how you play it, and I don't think Norma plays it that way.
I feel like they solidify the whole dynamic too of like, there's so many songs and there's so many lines and monologues about like, I'm the papa, I'm the man of the house, I make all the decisions, I tell people what to do. But then you see all of these scenes, and it happens with the two of them, with Tevye and Golda quite a bit, but then you see it happen with Saitl and Model, of like, the men are like, I'm in charge, and the women are like, please. And then you see what's the action, because the men were going out and like making a living and doing all that shit, but the women were running the household and raising the children and cooking and doing everything else. So
yeah, totally.
I don't know. I've always, maybe it's how the musical was brought to me through my voice teacher and stuff. But to me, Golda was always like, she wasn't a nag. She was just the strong woman that kind of had to put up with the goofy guy that did silly things from time to time.
Yeah. Sure. And she's very aware of who her husband is, right?
She's very self-possessed.
Yeah. Oh, sure. Yeah. Okay. So some other things, because while I'm listing these like other people that were almost cast, I think it's worth mentioning Model was almost Rob Reiner. And it also went to it was offered to John Ritter.
All right.
Oh, wow.
Would've been interesting. And then it was also offered to Richard Dreyfuss. Now, could have been interesting. He does sing. But I've also been recently, Blank Check Podcast has been covering Fosse. And they just did All That Jazz.
Mm-hmm.
They had Lin-Manuel Miranda on as the guest. It was
fantastic. My God,
it's a fantastic episode. I highly recommend it. But they covered All That Jazz. And they talk about how Fosse is... All That Jazz is a biopic of Fosse's life, directed by Fosse, written and directed by Fosse.
Yeah.
Wow.
So it's like very, you know, Hal Prince. There's someone that plays Hal Prince. There's somebody that plays Neil Simon. There's somebody that it's like everyone in his life. And Richard Dreyfuss was originally playing Fosse, which in the movie his name is like Gideon, something Gideon. I don't know, Gideon or something like that. But he's playing Fosse in the movie for a couple of weeks of rehearsal. And then he drops out. And all the accounts basically say that Dreyfuss just could not dance.
Oh, wow.
Just, like, could not pick up the steps. And it was Fosse. So they're like, all right, yeah, well, maybe. Yeah. So who do they end up casting? Do either of you know who they end up casting as Fosse in All
Roy
That
Scheider.
Jazz? It's Roy Scheider, the other star from Jaws.
Jaws, yeah. And I think they had a falling out for a while because of that.
I think that's true. I think you're right. Yeah. But he takes it on, and he's not really a dancer either, but they cut around it enough that he can, like, do the thing, and then they cut away, you know. So that's all very interesting. But then Leonard Frey goes on to get an Oscar nom. He was not playing this role on Broadway. He was playing other smaller roles in the ensemble on Broadway.
Oh, okay.
And auditioned and got it, which is all pretty cool.
That is cool.
He was playing, you know, like the rabbi's son who's like with him and
right.
like things like that, the smaller things. Or like Nahum the beggar or like whatever, you know, he was mm-hmm, those kind of things. Mm-hmm. The only other person I want to shout out, actually, I'll see if you can guess it. Who did they want for Perchik? Someone that was at not the height of their fame necessarily, but at a big time in their fame, a massive star even to this day. Someone who has been Oscar nominated many times, probably won some. I can't remember at this point, and is now an old man who does like Nancy Meyers movies and other things like
that.
He's in one of the Godfathers.
Okay. Marlon Brando.
Robert De Niro.
Huh.
Because think about age at the time, right? He's a bit younger. So in 71, right? So they wanted De Niro. He turned it down. We don't really know why. But I don't know that. Is he a singer?
I don't know.
No, it wouldn't have
right?
worked.
Right? Because that Perchik sings well, I feel like.
Yeah.
Does he even sing? Does Perchik sing?
He has a song. Well, he has a song in the musical, but I don't know if they cut it for the movie.
But I was wondering if it's in the movie or not. Yeah. There's a few cut songs.
Right.
It's interesting.
One, and please correct me if I'm wrong. Once I realized that Norman Jewison also directed Jesus Christ Superstar, and I remember saying this about it when we covered the movie last time, was something I love about this movie is they hired a bunch of people that felt like theater people, and it sounds like they were trying to go for some big fucking names, and then they didn't. And it's, I don't know, I just, Jesus Christ Superstar is like that, where you have like the two main characters, but then you have all of these side characters that have a great song or a couple great scenes, and they just hired a lot of talented people that knocked the part out of the role, as opposed to,
yeah,
who can we get that's going to put butts in seats?
And I think that was Jewison, because he was both producer and director. He was able to sort of, he didn't have anybody overseeing any of that. So he was the one who, like you said, Scott, wanted it to be a little darker, a little less Zero Mostel, right? Mm-hmm. A little less. And so I think he just went with more like looks and vibes.
Looks and vibes. I mean, because...
You're right. It's incredible.
I mean, because how many of them went on to do other big stuff?
Yeah. Perchik did Starsky and Hutch.
Yeah, I mean, sure. Yeah. I mean, and that's the joke. Like, it's kind of a little hard to watch it, like, in that sense, like, because you're so aware of that. But none of the women really did anything after that. And Topol's sort of the star.
And it's like Ted Neely and Jesus Christ Superstar just kept doing Jesus forever. And I know Topol's done a lot more stuff, but he's, you know, until a couple years ago was still doing Tevye. Yeah. So,
yeah.
Well, it's kind of, you know, it's like Ellen Green in Little Shop. We'll get to that. I mean, you know, she still does it now and then. And I think she's in her 60s, right? Maybe 70 years old.
Yeah.
But you just, you know, sorry. Just because I just saw her picture while I was scrolling through, I just want to shout this out. Molly Picone as Yenta, phenomenal performance.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
And it was like, you know, older at this time, but was a huge star.
Right.
So she's maybe somebody that, and Norma Crane had a career, but Molly Picone obviously is a massive star. But you're correct that, like, Hoddle, Hava, Seidel, they don't really, I'm looking at their IMDBs, like, some interesting stuff in here, like... the documentary about Fiddler on the Roof.
Seidel didn't really do anything else afterwards.
Yeah,
that actress.
She did play Seidel specifically. Rosalind Harris did play Fanny Bryce in The Cotton Club.
Yes.
Oh,
kind of interesting. But that's it. Like, that's really all she does. I'm trying to find the other ones, but their performances are great.
They all, and again, it's all, the whole thing is put together. Everything, every box is clicked. The music check, story check, actors check, DP check, director check, production design check. Like, it all just looks gorgeous. And like, just some of those scenes in the second act, like when he's just moving the goddamn, the cart across frozen waste tundra.
Well,
land,
and even when they leave Anatevka, I'm bawling my eyes
out. Oh, God, of course,
I mean, and it's just absolutely incredible. I want to hear your favorite numbers in the show, y'all. But first, CJ, you did say something minorly blasphemous, and I just have to point it out.
Oh, no.
Paul Michael Glazer of Starsky and Hutch.
Uh-huh.
Yes, he did Starsky and Hutch. He's done some other cool stuff. Specifically, he directed The Running Man.
He did. He
okay?
Did.
Which we love.
I think what I was more speaking to was where they were when they were cast in this movie.
Oh,
as opposed to, like, what did they do
afterwards? Right, no. But when we're talking about, like, but the question was presented by Scott, what have the women done?
Yes.
And, like, maybe some of the men haven't. He's also, here's the thing.
Okay.
He's also in one of my favorite movies of all time, which is also a Nancy Meyers film. We already brought up Nancy Meyers. This is Diane Keaton, Jack Nicholson, Keanu Reeves joint. What is it? Anyone?
Wait. Oh, Wolf? Was it Wolf?
No. What? Nancy Meyers. Nancy Meyers movie with Jack Nicholson, Diane Keaton, Keanu Reeves, Amanda Peet, Frances McDormand. Anyone? No. Something's gotta give. Are you kidding?
Oh, it's not we're great,
gonna,
bro.
First Wives Club. I'm gonna, as good
we're
as
we're going
gets.
To First Wives Club rocks, first of all. Yes. As good as it gets is fine. Nope. This is here's we're gonna cover Something's Gotta Give as an and stuff. After I finish the lives, I'm gonna make y'all watch it. Because not only is it a brilliant film, but also it's about a woman writing a play about the circumstances that she's in. So we're gonna watch it.
Yeah, it's fine.
I love that movie.
It's okay.
Keanu Reeves is great in that movie.
He's okay.
I'm gonna throw this chair at your face. I'm so angry now. I'm kidding. But Paul Michael Glazer has been great. What are your favorite numbers in this film? Because the first thing that always comes to mind, no matter what, for me is the bottle dance.
Oh, of course. Fucking yes.
Every time. I just
that
go.
That whole goddamn
blim,
wedding.
Blim, 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 blim,
the
blim,
whole
blim,
wedding.
Blim,
oh, my God. Blim, blim, blim,
get blim, me a fucking blim, clarinet. Blim, I want to hear it. Yeah.
So good. Yeah.
Yeah. That's fantastic. The whole wedding is just gorgeous. I, last night in rewatching, loved the. Do you still love me? Do you love
Do
me?
You love me.
Oh my God. Yeah. Like, and
Do
they both
I
play
love
it.
You.
And it's like, you know, yeah, neither of them are the prettiest, best voices ever, but they're both so in the moment and just them sitting on the bed and it's so intimate and lovely.
But I could
oh.
listen to Topol go from his extremely low register all the way up to his little like voice cracks. I could listen to that all day.
Yes.
Oh yeah. I did
doing?
Notice
me
and Krasner, Brian Krasner, friend of the pod and my roommate, we were watching it. He gets into Tom Hardy Bane voice territory a few times.
But Tom Hardy is doing vaguely a Topol.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Maybe yeah, that's a better way to put it.
Yeah,
it
on the roof, you say, Batman.
Yeah, Topol did it first.
A fiddler on the roof. I actually do a really solid Tom Hardy Bane. It's fine.
I thought he was a great villain. Bane scared the fuck out of me. Everyone made fun of him, but he was scary.
Well, they did re-record all of his lines because apparently they did some test screenings and everyone was like,
people were like,
we cannot hear a word he's saying.
A word is
and he's
on.
Squeaking. He was going like, oh, what are you doing?
I like the Bane and Harley Quinn, the
oh, it's
series.
Hilarious.
So great. For my favorite songs, I have so many. I mean, Tradition is great. The whole fucking violin solo while the credits are rolling is great. If I Were a Rich Man has hardcore singing into my hairbrush in front of my mirror.
Uh-huh.
L'Chaim is great. Sunrise, Sunset, The Sabbath Prayer. There's so many good songs.
Yeah, that's all first act though, right? Like,
but what? I also love Do You Love Me. That's a beautiful one too.
Yeah, that's beautiful. I also love all of the little asides. I know some of those are spoken, but in the musical some of them are sung.
Mm-hmm.
And there's like those kind of things. I love the dream.
Oh, the dream sequence.
Is it Tevye's Nightmare or
Tevye's Nightmare? Yeah. It Frumacera. Because if you have a good Frumacera, it can rock. You know, you
that's
make her massive and fly around
the stage. That's where they got to get super theatrical in the movie, too. Like,
absolutely.
They fucking went for it. And I read something about
Frumacera.
They used a crazy film filter for that particular scene, too. Like, they just went for it.
Yeah it's really, really cool.
It's gorgeous.
Mm-hmm.
Gorgeous.
What else do we want to say? We've been going almost an hour now. I figure...
We've been going, yeah, over
and over. Do we want to split these episodes?
Yeah, I think we have to. Yeah.
I think we have to.
I think we have to because we'll, yeah.
Yeah. We'll save our end stuff. Our end stuff, not our end stuff. It's different. We'll save our end stuff for Little Shop then.
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Well, we don't need to do spotlights because this will come out Sunday and then we'll have another one Wednesday.
Right.
Yeah.
I don't have any spotlights anyway right now.
I don't have any spotlights either. Go see Freestyle Love Supreme.
Yeah.
That's all I got. Okay. Is there any final thoughts you have on Fiddler on the Roof, the film?
It's a masterpiece.
Masterpiece.
I'm so glad we watched it.
Yeah, good call.
It was fun. Now we need to watch it together.
CJ's pick. Thanks, Siege.
Yeah. Thanks for indulging me. I just love this movie so much.
It's one of those I haven't I haven't put on in so long. Same. Because it's a commitment. It's two and a half hours, right? It's like, okay, I'm going to sit down and I'm going to watch Fiddler. It's a rarity, you know?
Yeah.
But so worth it. Such a good time. I enjoyed it. I implore you all to please go watch this film again. I think I watched it on something. Did I stream? Oh, no. I have the Blu-ray. Sorry. I watched the Blu-ray. anything else, y'all? Final thoughts?
No, that's it. Why don't we wrap it?
It's 3 hours long, by the way. I said it was two and a half hours. It's 3 hours
and 3 hours and 1 minute.
3 hours and 1 minute. Yeah. Also rated G.
That surprised me.
For good times.
Yeah.
Well, the rating system was different back then. They had G and PG. So if it was PG, it was like, oh, boobies.
Right.
Oh.
yeah, okay, cool. Well, then thanks for joining us for part one of four of theater bonus sixth episode about movies and stuff. Turning musicals into movies. That's what we're calling it.
Yeah.
Thanks for joining us for Fiddler on the Roof. That's all I got.
Do y'all have questions, comments? Let us know what y'all thought about Fiddler on the Roof. Who did you play when you did the Summer Theater Guild version of it? Was it appropriate? Probably not. But anyway, you can email us. You can also reach us on Instagram, Twitter, or Facebook. Scott?
Thank you, CJ. A big shout out to Ryan Thomas Johnson, who writes our theme song. Our theme song is better than your theme song.
It is true.
A big shout out to Pamela Quinn, who wrote our special and stuff bonus episode song, which you heard at the beginning of this episode. She'll be with us next time to talk more stuff, and we love her. And Pam's a genius. She's genius. Yeah. And finally, to the great Pulitzer Prize winning playwright Annie Baker, who writes every single one of our episodes.
Hey, Scott.
Yeah.
I'm going to stop doing this bit because I just want you to get through this one time without me interrupting you like an Annie Baker play.
I think it's fucking hilarious.
And yeah, you're right. I'm going to keep doing it.
One day, Annie Baker, we're going to buy you a beer.
Yeah.
It's true. We're going to buy you a beer. We're going to buy you a PBR or whatever you want. Hefeweizen. Subscribe, rate, review. We love you all so deeply. And we'll see you next time for Little Shop of Horrors. Go watch it.
Me.
I've learned to slam on the brake before I even turn the key, before I make the mistake, before I lead with the worst of me. Give them no reason to stare. No slipping up, you slip away. I don't even know these notes. So I got nothing to share. No, I got nothing to say. Step out of the sun if you keep getting burned. step out of the sun because you've learned. Because you've learned.
Meow.
Later, everybody.
On the outside.
The theater. The theater. Theater.